From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, we'll spend a few minutes with Adrian Haslett-Davis. What has this year been like for the ballroom dancer who vowed to dance again after losing a leg to the Boston bombings?
But first, let's go to South Korea and the latest on the ferry that capsized with hundreds of people on board, including many teenagers who were on a school field trip. The ship is now entirely submerged in the frigid waters of the Yellow Sea. More than 260 people are missing, though rescuers are holding out some hope that there may be survivors on board who might have managed to find air pockets within the vessel. Jason Strother is a freelance journalist based in Seoul, South Korea. Jason, welcome.
Thank you, Meghna.
This is a really tough story. Apparently, the ship is now entirely underwater, but I see today that divers managed to at least breach the hull of the ferry, and two divers possibly even entered the second deck. What more can you tell us about progress that's been made?
Right. I mean, weather conditions, tidal conditions had not been in the divers' favor. After many attempts for the past couple of days, they were able to enter the hull of the ship. But from what I understand, visibility was very low, although there had been some slim hopes that they might find survivors maybe holding on in air pockets. No such luck on the dive today.
But in addition to the ongoing rescue efforts, there's news that arrest warrants are now being sought for the captain and several crew members. Tell us more about that.
Captain Lee has become, I think, the chief villain in this whole ordeal for the past couple days. He appeared on South Korean television on Thursday, very contrite, very apologetic, although more or less hiding his face from the cameras the whole time. It was revealed today during a press conference that he wasn't even at the helm when the ship began to capsize. It turns out one of his junior officers, a third mate, was at the wheel. It's not entirely clear yet why the captain had gone away. And from what I understand, based on interviews with other crew members, the authorities think they have enough evidence to seek this arrest warrant for Captain Lee, as well as a few other of his crew members.
Now, one of the most difficult parts of this story is the fact that more than 230 students are still missing. They were aboard the ferry. And we also see now that the vice principal of their school was found hanged on the school grounds in what looks like an apparent suicide.
Yeah, it kind of just making an already difficult story even worse. The vice principal, who was a survivor of the shipwreck himself, he was accompanying these kids when they were on this school trip to Jeju Island. His body was found hanging from a tree outside of the gymnasium on Jindo Island, where all the families are camped out pretty much for the past couple days, waiting for any news about their children. I don't want to speculate, but right, it reflects the stress that is being felt by everyone involved in this case.
Now, Jason, what are survivors and family members, what are they saying about the rescue efforts so far and the just crush of media attention that they've been getting as they wait to find out what's happened to their family members?
I visited the high school in the town of Ansan, just south of Seoul, where all of these 320 students and the faculty were from. It's a sad scene there. The auditorium in the school has pretty much turned into a news center. And while I was there yesterday, kind of a scrum of journalists had surrounded a woman who was weeping. And then that prompted another gentleman in the room to, you know, chastise the journalists in there. So, right, the families are very weary about the media attention. Today, the family members issued a statement saying that they're furious with how this whole ordeal has been handled. They say the government botched everything from the start. They went to the South Coast thinking their kids were still alive, only to find out on their way there that many were missing. And they say that the government, the Coast Guard, the Navy, just hasn't come through with its pledges that it made initially to get into the ship, to pump oxygen into the ship. They're very angry, and they seem to be right now between the government and the captain pointing the finger of blame at them.
And finally, Jason, there's an investigation going on trying to uncover the cause of the accident. Has there been any progress on that front?
There's probably no way to really determine what happened until authorities can raise the vessel out of the water. And already cranes have been brought to the scene, and the Navy plans to start lifting, but there are many logistic problems that need to be worked out first before they can hoist the ship out of the water and bring it back to land for inspection.
Jason Strother reporting from South Korea. Jason, thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
And now we're going to visit with a favorite guest and her brother, Timothy, who's come to run for her in the Boston Marathon on Monday. Let's back up. This week, we've been marking the one-year anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombings, hearing from people like Dr. Ron Medzin of Boston Medical Center, who spoke to us the day after the bombings last year, about a survivor who came through his emergency room.
One of the women I was talking with, who also had a really bad leg injury, was telling me that she was a competitive dancer, and you know, I just felt super horrible. And, I mean, there are no words.
I remember telling a lot of doctors that I was a ballroom dancer and that it was extremely important that I kept my foot, that I could still feel every toe and move every toe.
And then ultimately what happened?
I woke up and I didn't have a foot anymore.
How are you?
It's so cold.
It's crazy.
That young woman was Adrienne Haslett Davis, a professional ballroom dancer.
It's so good to see you. The last time I saw you, I didn't even have a leg yet, right?
Right.
You know, we could go.
Last year, she invited us to her hospital room just after the bombings. We went to her apartment building last night. Anything been going on?
it's kind of a loaded question, yes. Just a couple things.
Adrienne has become a familiar face, pledging to dance again on Dancing with the Stars.
When I heard from Dancing with the Stars, I was so incredibly nervous, excited, happy. I just couldn't believe it.
And she's now apparently Anderson Cooper's new dance instructor on CNN.
And I feel like...
I don't know. I stay rock solid because I'm such a bad dancer.
We're going to change that.
Well, I said
told you. I told you I'm going to teach you.
I would like to teach you.
And Adrienne also spoke at this week's memorial in Boston with her husband, Adam, a vet who just returned from Afghanistan and was with Adrienne when the bombs went off, looking on.
I have also learned that it is okay to not be okay, that we still have to let ourselves grieve. We can stay in bed even for a few days. Yet it is that Boston strong attitude that gets us back out, and when we cannot find the strength to do it ourselves, we have those around us that lift us back up.
There's a lot going on this week.
Yeah, there is, but I try and take it day by day. Today's a great day. I get to spend it with my brother and family, so it keeps you grounded, it keeps you healthy, it keeps you sane, and you take it day by day.
And Timothy, your brother, here from Washington State, are you going to be running, do I hear?
I will be running, yes. Yep.
How are you both approaching the marathon? Timothy, start with you. I can't imagine how emotional that is. You've been in Washington State, your sister all the way across the continent when this happened.
Quite a distance. I can't wait to jump in and just be a part of this. This is a strong statement against the evil and injustice, and this is our stand, this is our run to say, no, this is not how it should be and not how it's going to be. And
Adrienne, you're nodding.
Yes, I'm nodding. I completely agree. It's a strong statement of, it's bigger than what happened last year. It's a statement of love and support, and you can't get that more than with family.
Yeah, and as family, you want to be together. And I think older brother to younger sister, you just want to be out there. You want to say, come on, you want to face the evil, and you want to take their place. And that was completely not possible for me. So I channel that into everybody's strength I have for this race. And so this is my chance.
How's your stomach approaching the day, though?
Yeah, it's tough. You know, it's really tough. I physically feel uneasy. Hard to think that it's been a year. I don't think I'm scared of the marathon. I think it's just I'm nervous to not know what kind of emotional state I'll be in at that time. I just want to feel safe, and I want the city to feel safe and comfortable and to go out and show support like they did during the Red Sox parade and pack the streets like 70 deep. It was so loud, and I was cheering for the Red Sox, but I was mostly cheering for the people that were cheering.
But did you ever have second thoughts of going back? I mean, you are going back.
Yes, I am. I am going back. I'm going back with my husband, Adam, and a couple of our friends.
How is Adam?
He's doing well. You know, we both take it day by day. As much as it's easy to see that I have lost my limb, he has suffered tremendously as well. He has constant ringing in his ears, and that can drive a person crazy. And he's coping as beautifully as you possibly could in that situation. He also doesn't have feeling in his left foot from the ankle forward. So it's tough. You know, he's limping by the end of the day and trying to stay strong for both of us. And
like you said, he doesn't have as visible a sign to people of, I have this injury.
Right. And, you know, that's something that we both feel really passionate about, to make people aware of the injuries that people don't see. You know, when I'm walking down the street, it's hard for even people to see that I have lost a limb, because I cover it with jeans and such. But it's also incredibly important to us, as I raised awareness during the memorial speech about PTSD, which is the completely invisible wound that so many people have, and so many soldiers have, being in the military. And being a military wife, that's really important for me to bring it to the civilian world.
One of the most powerful moments visiting with you guys a year ago was his complete helplessness. You know, here he was just back from war. He's a soldier. He expected to meet IEDs. He didn't expect to have one 2 weeks back from Afghanistan, and he didn't expect to not be able to help his own wife, because he couldn't. He was incapacitated.
Yeah, you know, it was really tough for him. You know, he said multiple times that he carried a tourniquet on his arm for almost 6 months, and the one time he needed it, he didn't. And thankfully, he wore a belt that day, and he was able to use that. But he did help me in the sense that he was my first responder. Mm. He's always been my first responder, whether it's crying over a commercial and him just hugging me, or being on the side of the road and feeling completely helpless. But yeah, he was feeling like he wanted to be able to prevent that. That's why he joined the military, so things like this don't happen.
So he's doing better.
He is doing better. You know, we're both doing better, but we never want to say we're healed. We're not.
Adrian Haslett Davis, she and her husband Adam survived the Boston bombing. We'll have more with Adrian and her brother Timothy just ahead, Here and Now. It's Here and Now, and if you've just joined us, we're catching up with Adrian Haslett Davis and her brother Timothy, who's visiting Adrian from Washington State, where they grew up, and is going to run the marathon in honor of Adrian and other survivors of last year's bombing this coming Monday. This is a rare, quiet moment for this young woman, who's become one of the faces of survival of the Boston Marathon. She was the ballroom dancer who lost her lower leg in the bombing and promised to dance on Dancing with the Stars, appeared with Anderson Cooper on CNN with a bright pink warmer covering her stump. We first met Adrian just days after the bombings. She invited us to her hospital room, even days after that terrible event. She wanted to reclaim her life. And we visited her again last night. You were the first to decide, I want my story out, I want to talk. I remember going to see you and thinking, gosh, she's just so, it must be drugs because she's so positive. And then I realized that's how you are.
Well, you know, it certainly helped with the drugs, I'm not going to lie. It was when there's something this traumatic happens to you, you can't feel anything from the chest down. So it definitely helps for sure. But yes, I am a very positive person. And it doesn't mean I was positive every second of every day, but I tried to find the positive. You know, I was looking back, I'm doing a lot of reflecting over the past, you know, year, but especially over the past week. And I was looking at photos today on my phone, and they're all timestamped. And the photo today, a year ago, was a bunch of red keg cups in and a bunch of hands from friends holding them. Oh, and it was sparkling cider and orange juice. They snuck in that to mimic mimosas. And so it was wonderful to be able to celebrate those little things. You know, we were just celebrating life at that moment.
But you had obviously made this decision. What do you think it is? Is it the performer in you that is demanding to still be on the world stage? You're nodding.
Yeah. You know, I'm nodding because I guess I didn't think of it in that way before. I think Tim could attest to this, that we grew up with parents with an independent children's bookstore, and we were not exposed to a lot of television, and we didn't, you know, we weren't like I didn't grow up to want to be on TV or want to be in the media. The main reason why I am out in the media is because of people that I have heard about along the way. I researched early on and saw blogs from other amputees that were titled, I saw two of them that were titled something similar to "used to be a dancer." And I thought, oh my gosh, how horrific is that? They gave up on their dream because they lost their leg. And that's so incredibly sad to me. And it's so hard. And there was a 13-year-old girl her parents told her that this was a big old inconvenience, that she got into an accident and lost her leg. And I think about all these people that do not have the support system, and I am speaking out so that they have somebody that hopefully they can turn to or know that they're not alone.
Wow. So you, in the first few days, you were researching and planning how you were going to approach this.
I certainly didn't think that I'd be in the media for this long. That wasn't the plan, but I knew that there were people out there that were alone, and I didn't want them to feel alone. What I'm exposed to, and what I think a lot of us are exposed to, is we have a lot of behind-the-scenes support that nobody would ever know. The media would never know. And we get together, we see each other, we purposely don't tell the media, we purposely don't take pictures, we purposely turn the cameras off and make sure that nobody hears about it. So we have a support network within ourselves that is unbreakable.
Yeah. You see this mission that she was just describing, this need. She's been thrust in this arena head on, and is like a tea bag in water, is creating this wonderful brew of hope and perseverance and all.
There's a great saying about women are like tea bags. Yeah, put them in hot water, and they
and they you see how great they really are, right? Yeah. Now that I am, I certainly want to use my voice for good, and especially young girls that are out there facing this and feeling alone. And there's a large part of your body that feels like it's completely broken. I remember feeling like my body was so foreign to me at the age of 32, which is something you've gotten used to by then. I felt like I had a hand growing out of my forehead. I just felt so different than every person on the planet. And that is a horrible feeling.
Are you still having some of that? We're hearing from the other amputees. I think it was Heather Abbott who got up one morning. She had a beautiful sleep, got up and forgot and fell.
Yeah, absolutely. The amputees early on that would come in from Wounded Warriors or Amputee Coalition of America would come in and say, you know, put a chair by your bed for the first year or two so that you don't get out of bed groggy and hurt yourself. You could land on that tibia bone and then you can't wear your leg and you're back in the hospital and repairing it for surgery. Wow. It's very scary.
We're talking about getting up in the morning. What do you dream about?
You know, it's interesting. I had my first dream as an amputee about 2.5 months ago, actually. And I went in to my therapist and he said, oh my gosh, wait, you said you were an amputee? And I said, yes. And he said, that is incredible. Your subconscious believes that you're an amputee. That usually doesn't happen for the first 5 years. So I thought that was really interesting. And I've had dreams since then that I'm an amputee, both that I have both limbs and I'm an amputee. But I was very proud of myself that is already happening within the first year. So he was shocked. And I like to be an overachiever when it comes to recovery, so I was happy that that happened.
Obviously, you have waking dreams, too. What are they?
Gosh, you know, I want to continue to heal. I'm not there yet. I want to make sure that I'm not giving up on fulfilling the dreams that I set out to do and to accomplish and make sure that this doesn't define me. I think that the prosthetic world is a bit dinosaur in some ways, as far as the majority of practice. And so I hope to be a part of the advancements of prosthetics and help to get especially women's prosthetics and women's cosmetic prosthetics covered under insurance and Medicare.
They're not?
No, not the cosmetic skin.
All amputees we know ordinarily need more than one leg. Certain legs are not covered.
No, certain legs are not covered and certain skins are not covered.
They're $100,000 a piece.
Yeah, they can be. Yeah, they can be even more than that. Yeah. It's been a real learning experience and something that I feel like there are a lot of things that people are doing really right and there are a lot of things that people can really improve on.
Yeah. Well, it has been quite a year. I guess I just want to wish you both the very best. On Marathon Day.
I can't be more proud of Tim and then also and David, our other brother, is running as well. And I'm so thankful that they're here in this pivotal time, in this emotional time between the anniversary and the marathon. I'm just excited for Boston to come out and have an amazing race.
It's going to be good. And I just can't wait to be out there in the crowds and the cheers. And
I will say that as this is how supportive my brothers are, that normally don't rock hot pink. they are wearing hot pink leg warmers on their left, or I should say compression sleeves. I shouldn't say leg warmer. It's a compression sleeve. It's a manly term. But they're wearing the hot pink on their left leg to honor the first interview that I did with Anderson Cooper, and that got a lot of play. There were people that showed up the next day in support of all the survivors wearing a hot pink leg warmer. So they'll be rocking it. So if you see them out on the course, be sure to cheer extra loud.
Thank you. Thank you both so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Adrian Haslett-Davis and her brother Timothy Haslett, who will be running in honor of his sister this Monday at the Boston Marathon. By the way, you may also have heard that Adrian walked off the set of Meet the Press this past Sunday because she'd asked that they not ask her about the alleged bombers, and they couldn't agree. She says that is part of her strategy for surviving the attacks, not looking back. You're listening to Here and Now.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now. In Syria today, a car bomb killed more than a dozen people in the city of Homs. That's also where a beloved Dutch priest, 75-year-old Father Frans Vanderlut, was recently killed. He was shot by a masked gunman who entered his monastery. Vanderlut's death is part of an escalating spiral of violence against Christians in Syria. They're being attacked and kidnapped in increasing numbers, and their churches are being damaged or destroyed, forcing many Syrian Christians to flee. The BBC's Lise Doucette is in Syria, and she spoke to one Jesuit Christian, Father Naraz Samour, who has decided to stay.
It's become increasingly difficult and dangerous in Syria today for the leading members of the Christian community. Two bishops kidnapped in the north, one kidnapped in an area under Islamist control, another shot dead, murdered in the city, the old city of Homs. So to get a sense of the mood among Christians in Syria, I've come to visit one of the leading Jesuit fathers, Father Naraz. Father Naraz, it's been another difficult year for Syrians, for all Syrians, but we've seen more suffering and sadness in a week that for Christians is one of the most, possibly the most important week in the Christian calendar. But with so many Christian leaders who are either killed or kidnapped, do you believe the Christian community is being targeted?
I used to say for a long time, no. I mean, the suffering of Christian community is the same like others. I used to say that we don't have the monopoly of suffering, which is true. But something I couldn't understand, in some areas, some people, why they attack to the Christian symbols? I mean, if you don't agree, you don't agree. I don't have any problem with that. But attacking to symbols in such situation, it's painful. It's painful. So yes, we are from that country. We are a part of that population. We suffer like others. We are, but in some places, we are targeted because we are Christian. That's true. And now, I can't go to some places because if they know I'm Christian, I could be killed for the simple fact that I'm Christian.
With every year that passes, sadly, more churches are desecrated. More Christian leaders, sadly, are killed or kidnapped, and Christians leave. Do you worry about the future of the Christian community in Syria?
If I allow the negative feeling in myself to give me my conception of the reality, my way of seeing the reality, I would say, yeah, I'm afraid about the future of the Christian community. I mean, if they, the majority of Christians, if they had that possibility to get out of Syria and to be asylums in elsewhere, especially in Europe, in America, in Canada, Australia, whatever, they would leave, 90%, I would say, without exaggeration. But I know, on the other hand, some people who made the decision to stay, even though they have another passport or another citizenship or whatever. I would say it's a critical moment for the church in this region, not only Syria, in this region. Several years ago, it was Iraq, before Lebanon, Egypt, Syria, Israel, Palestine. So what future for the church here? It's a question, an open question, yes. And the answer is going to shape the future of that community.
Father Naraz Samour speaking to the BBC's Lise Doucette in Damascus, Syria. You're listening to Here and Now. It's Here and Now. You've heard of peak oil, but what about peak beard? And I'm serious about this because a new study says the ebb and flow of whether men grow beards may be guided by a sort of Darwinian selection. Scientists in Australia say when peak beard frequency is reached, the pendulum swings back toward the less bristled chin. In other words, the more beards there are, the less attractive they become, suggesting that clean-shaven men have a competitive advantage when everyone else is trying to look like Grizzly Adams. The study is published in the Royal Society journal Biology Letters, and my bearded colleague, Jeremy Hobson, spoke to the BBC's science reporter James Morgan about it, starting with how the study was conducted.
So they got a group of women and men, and they showed them pictures of different male faces in what they call four standard levels of beardedness, which is clean-shaven, then a kind of light stubble, which is kind of sort of 5 o'clock shadow, then, you know, sort of a heavy stubble, which it might be, you know, a few days growth, and then the full beard, you know, really bushy kind of look. And they asked them to rate them. And but what was interesting was, you know, some people liked beards, some people didn't. Some people thought some guys looked hot with beards. Some people thought, no, he needs, you know, he needs to shave. but what was interesting was really what mattered most was how many beards there were. If there were loads of beards in the sample they were shown, suddenly the kind of smooth, clean-shaven look became much more attractive. If they saw lots and lots of clean-cut guys, then, you know, the odd kind of strong, like, hairy chin became suddenly very, you know, very appealing. So what they're seeing here is that actually the beard, the attractiveness of the beard depends not just on you, it depends on your rivals and what they've got going on.
So whatever most people have becomes less attractive than what just a few people have.
Exactly. And that's surprising in evolution because typically, right, we think of evolution, you know, a strong trait comes along and on man and the females like it, like, say, in fish, for instance, you know, a bright coloured coat, the females like it, it maybe signifies some kind of good genes, and then it spreads through the male population. But then it, what we see with certain kind of display traits on animals and on actually now in humans is that it doesn't become fixed. Something odd happens, which is when there become so many of something, the females change their mind and they go for something else instead. And so it's not just how attractive a beard is, it's how many beards there are around it. And they call that negative frequency dependent selection. And it's kind of one of the paradoxes of evolution. But I guess, you know, for the gentleman out there, what it means is no matter what your kind of natural look is, if you're in the right place, you could be the alpha. You could have the best chance.
And there's an interesting factor here, which is that there's a pendulum that swings back and forth, that sometimes a bearded person will be more attractive and sometimes a clean-shaven person will be more attractive, and that it's just going to bounce back and forth and back and forth over time.
That's right. We see these cycles in fashion of men's facial hair. I mean, it's a beautiful study where they looked at men's beards in London Illustrated magazine right back to the 1870s and all the way through to about 1970s. And you saw the moustaches come and go. You saw the sideburns were in for a while. You saw the beards. And what you see is there's this kind of flow and turnaround. You know, that people say the handlebar moustache in the 70s might come back now because, you know, we've had enough time. Maybe, you know, part of what's driving this is not just celebrities in the news and fashion fads. Maybe there is something a little bit more Darwinian going on here, you know, or at least something that's very similar in pattern to Darwinian selection. And that's kind of funny, I think.
Are we at peak beard right now?
Well, that is a hot debate here in the UK, where just around Christmas time, a famous news presenter, Jeremy Paxman, he shaved his beard off, and meanwhile, I think George Clooney shaved his off, and so although all the news media were saying, right, we've passed it, that's it, because you know the hipsters and the hippies may always love the beard, but. What we might now be seeing an end of is things like bankers, you know, traders, footballers, you know, sports stars having beards, which they never used to be common in professions. It never used to be acceptable to come into to the office as a, you know, an executive and have a lot of bristles on your face. And maybe very soon now it will no longer be acceptable again.
Well, here in this country, we'll have to wait until Wolf Blitzer shaves his beard off on CNN. I will be waiting for that. You spoke to some women in London about this trend. Let's listen to what they said.
Just the amount of beards need to go. It just seems like it's trending.
It's a bit like tattoos. It's too many, they become common.
Yeah.
So I'm not a really big fan of beards, so just feel like it's hiding the face.
Now, James, you have a beard, right?
I do. 12 years I've had this.
And are you going to shave it now that you know about this research?
This was a real dilemma, you know, when we looked at this. I was terrified because clearly, I mean, I live in East London, which is a very kind of hipster area. There are a lot of hirsute young gents around me. And so I'm getting no advantage from having this on my face. You know, it's if I really wanted to attract mates, then it needs to go. I could get an edge evolutionarily if I lose it. But I suppose there are other reasons for having a beard, right? I mean, the guys listening to this will tell you that they might have a beard because, you know, it feels comfortable because, frankly, it's a bit easier just to not shave. Or, you know, just kind of personal preference. It just looks good on some people, no matter what the fashion is at the time. So I, despite a lot of peer pressure here and despite the potential kind of mating advantage I might have in Hackney, I'm keeping it.
You know, I have a beard as well, and I shaved it a few years ago for the first time in a while, and it looked so strange when I looked in the mirror that I grew it right back, and I haven't gone back since, but we'll have to see.
Well, you know, the scientists say that, and when I went to a gents grooming salon here, there's a particularly famous one that does moustache waxing and kind of beard moisturizing. And they said, yeah, guys come in here, and, you know, maybe their girlfriend has said, no, it needs to go. And they're all psyched up for this kind of look at their jaw, and then at the minute that they shave it, they grow it right back, and that's it for life.
The BBC's science reporter James Morgan, and we'll put a picture of him up at our website hereandnow.org, so you can see the true use of a beard, right, James?
Yeah, I thank you for that. I'd like to think I'm a good user. Our BBC Breakfast TV did that with my photo yesterday, and it provoked quite a lot of response, some good, some bad. So now you're making me nervous.
James, thanks so much.
Thank you.
They called him the Beard, and he walked here.
Listeners, tweet us your favorite fantastic facial hair pictures. We're at Here and Now. You're listening to Here and Now.
Because of his facial hair.
It's Here and Now. So you say you want to be a chef, not a cook who, yes, cooks the food, but a chef who creates the menu, sometimes in a high-powered restaurant for hundreds of demanding patrons. Well, first you have to be a sous chef, a perpetual Mark Antony to chefs Julius Caesar, as our next guest puts it, a faithful administrator who can also call upon cooking skills at a moment's notice.
Since there is rarely only one guest ordering food in the dining room, it's rarely possible to do only one thing at a time. While one hand waggles a saucepan of demi-glace, the other lights the burner beneath the sautoir to make it hot for the next piece of fish due to go down. While one hand lays that piece of fish in a drop tray to be seasoned, the other hand reaches for the salt. If you spin away from the stove to toss a piece of trash into the bin, you take the opportunity to grab a fresh side towel from your station before spinning back. When your hands are full of mise en place you've just pulled from the fridge, a soft hip check brings the fridge door home. To take a pan from the stove, open the oven door, place the pan in the oven, and close the oven door is one fluid motion. While you read through the tickets on board, you keep busy cutting, chopping, stirring, sniffing, listening, all with a sense of urgency.
Sous chef Michael Gibney reading from his new book, Sous Chef, 24 Hours on the Line, a window into the hectic restaurant life in often excruciating, oops, the nuts roasting for the pâté just burned, detail. And Michael joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Michael Gibney, welcome.
Thank you so much.
What is it about working in the restaurant industry that is so compelling, not just to write about, but compels people to do it? And in your book, you illustrate how muscular it is. And well, how would you characterize it in a couple of words? How would you characterize being a sous chef?
Just by the one word, workhorse, that's a position where you find yourself doing probably the most work you'll ever do in your career, because you have to sort of behave a little bit like a cook and also behave a little bit like a chef. You're somewhere in between the two, so you have to do the jobs of both.
Let's tell us more about that. Mark Antony to Julius Caesar, someone who executes a chef's orders. What is a sous chef?
you're responsible essentially for managing the restaurant so that chef can focus on coming up with a menu or refining things as he or she sees fit. You're there to do the sort of daily business of running the place.
What about your relationship to the chef? It feels like a large dollop of respect and a huge dollop of fear.
I don't know if I would necessarily say fear. There's tension, though, because as a sous chef, like I said, you're no longer a cook, but you're also not the chef yet. So you're in this weird limbo between the two, and it's easy to start thinking, oh, well, I want my name to be on the menu or over the door. And you're constantly questioning yourself as to whether or not you're ready for that. Because, of course, with all the credit and all the respect comes a whole bunch of responsibility.
Which is why it's so intense in the kitchen. You move us through the day of you checking everything out, making sure the people who are actually prepping the foods are doing what they're supposed to do. And now, you know, you're actually in the kitchen. And you say, of all the conditions that can disrupt a kitchen's harmony, anger is probably the most dangerous. Why is it so intense in a kitchen?
Cooking professionally requires a lot of work. So everybody that participates in that is working really hard. And for an error on somebody else's part to create an emergency for them is a frustrating moment. The other thing is that it's such a moment-by-moment activity that to foul up hours of work with 1 second of inattention creates irreparable problems.
Well, because you're part, that's why they call it a line. Everybody's part of a line.
Yeah, well, now Escoffier, Auguste Escoffier, about 150 years ago, when sort of outlining the way a professional kitchen should be set up, called it the brigade de cuisine. And I don't think that it's an accident that he borrowed that term from the military.
Yeah. And you also point out how important it is to sort of keep the anger in check because everyone is armed with knives.
Well, in most kitchens, certainly not in the kitchen I describe in the book, I like to believe that in most kitchens, nobody's actually going to harm one another. We respect each other too much to do that. But it is important to keep a positive mental attitude because when your attitude goes off, you can taste it in the food and you can see it in your performance. And ultimately, we're there to feed guests, you know, and they trust that we're going to feed them something that's good and gets them their money's worth and that keeps them healthy and safe, you know, to nourish them. And I think once you have a negative attitude about that task, you've lost sight of what you're here to do in the first place.
One of the most interesting things that struck me is that as sous chef, you're also in charge of, once the chef decides what he wants the menu, he or she wants the menu to be, you have to make sure that the components are there. For instance, for this one particular menu, you might have to dig through the storeroom and find mustard oil, cornichons, and golden raisins. If they aren't there, it's your fault for not maintaining them. Later, there's a prep cook making turnips, and you have to know the steps to prep turnips. I mean, I can't even understand that paragraph of prepping a turnip.
all the things you have to know. That's what I mean. I think the sous chef has got sort of a lot of responsibility as the one who typically will be the one purchasing the food, maintaining all the pars in the different walk-in boxes and the storerooms, and then manage the execution of all the dishes on the menu. Chef, of course, will demonstrate how he or she wishes for things to be done, but then from there you're expected to sort of enforce those instructions with all the cooks. So you need to know everything about all the different ingredients, all the different preparations, the techniques, the recipes, the equipment. You know, if the equipment is finicky or on the fritz, you're expected to be able to figure out how to get it working properly or call the technician who will come in and do so. You're responsible for total management of the kitchen.
Yeah.
And ultimately, chef is the end of the line, but you don't want it to get to chef. You know, you don't want chef to be the one finding out that this isn't working and he or she needs to step in and take control because he or she's got better stuff to do.
Amazingly long days, then late nights, and not every sous chef gets to be the chef with the name and lights. Do people burn out?
Oh, absolutely. I think you age out. I think you physically, after a certain age, become incapable of participating in this sort of very physical activity. And then mentally, the strain, you know, because of all these things you need to know and think about, it gets difficult and frustrating to continue to do that, I think. So chef years can be measured, I think, more closely to dog years than to human years. I don't mean to say, though, that it's not without reward. I mean, the money, it's not about the money that we make or the titles that we have. There has to be some other calling, which I think, I hope, is the idea of feeding people and working really hard on behalf of somebody else with a team of people also working really hard in service of another. I think there's something really beautiful and rewarding in that, and that, I think, is what keeps people doing it.
Michael Gibney, one question, though. You are a sous chef. You're involved with food. Why do you smoke so much? The smoking breaks. It like, seems like the only break in the action that anybody from the kitchen gets. But it destroys your taste buds.
Well, I agree. I do take care to say that it's something that, you know, it's a bad habit. And the best chefs stopped smoking or never started smoking to begin with long ago. But I do think, as you say, it's this little break that you get from the action, a little break away from the heat, and a moment for you to recollect your thoughts and reconsider what it is that you've got ahead of you and what you've accomplished so far. To take a deep breath, get some fresh air, and
pollute it.
fresh, polluted, gross, tarry air, and reassess the situation, you know, take stock of what's going on.
Well, you left a great image, though, with this reader of all over Manhattan, people in the same outfits, those clogs and pants and white shirts, sneaking out to loading docks, you know, trying to get it.
Well, it's true, and I hope that people, you know, will start to notice them. I guess that's the point of the book, is to help people start to notice the folks who are behind the scenes.
Yeah.
In a new way, at least.
That's Michael Gibney. His book is Sous Chef, 24 Hours on the Line. Michael, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now.